Hi, I'm Steve Dace. So if you're looking for a summer worldview camp, this is the place to be. July 16th through the 20th, we're going to encourage your kids to become the next generation of cultural leaders. We've got pastors like Douglas Wilson, filmmakers, cultural critics and commentators like myself and Matt Walsh from The Daily Wire. Sign up at calledconference.ninja. Again, Moscow, Idaho, July 16th through the 20th, calledconference.ninja.
Hello and welcome back to the New St. Andrews College podcast. My name is Ben Merkel. I'm the president of New St. Andrews. And today I am joined by Dr. Jason Greaser. Jason is the fellow of literature at New St. Andrews and has taught quite a variety of courses over his time at NSA. Jason, what's your specialty? What's your sweet spot?
I'll tell you some of the classes I teach, and I think that'll answer that for you. But I teach a course called English, which begins with two terms of Chaucer, a term of Spenser, and then a term of Shakespeare. And then I teach some genre classes, literature courses, epic, novel, lyric, and tragedy. So those are my main courses. And I'm mainly in the Elizabethan, Jacobean period of English literature, but also a little bit outside of that in different electives.
Okay. And when you were in your doctoral dissertation, what was your focus there?
I studied the poetry of George Herbert.
So today we want to spend a little bit of time zeroing in on Shakespeare, and I think we're going to cover this in next week's episode as well, looking at Shakespeare and tragedy. Has that been a particular course of yours then?
Yes. It's also part of that genre class I mentioned called tragedy. I've also done an elective just called Shakespeare where we read several tragedies.
Okay. And so we're looking at Shakespeare's tragedies, specifically Macbeth today, but let's start a little bit more generally. When we refer to this genre of tragedy, what does that mean?
Yeah, a lot of people think of it as something sad. And I think it's sad in the old sense of the word sad, something serious. Okay. A tragedy is something that's elevated. It's something that's grand. And we do witness the destruction of a life in it, for sure. But it's also something that's a representation of that. So it's a work of art, and we get to sort of see it from a distance. And so we can, Aristotle makes the analogy of a visual work of art. So a painting of a corpse, we wouldn't want to see a corpse in real life, probably. But if you see a painting of a corpse, we'll go to a museum to see that. And that's strange, right? But it's mediated through art. Same with tragedy. You witness something terrible, but it's mediated in such a way that it's pleasurable, and it's even invigorating. He also talks about catharsis.
This is Aristotle.
Yeah. And critics, scholars aren't sure exactly what he means by that. But something like a purging or a refining of the emotions happens during a tragedy. So pity and fear are the two emotions he talks about the most. And he says that you suffer. When the tragic hero suffers, you feel pity for him. You also feel fear that it could be you. And so you're witnessing his suffering into truth, as Aeschylus put it. So in the end, it should be an invigorating experience, and not, you don't walk out, you know, sobbing.
You mentioned Aristotle as giving this definition. Is Aristotle's categories for literature, is that a prominent way of breaking things down?
For tragedy?
For tragedy, comedy, and are there other classifications?
Yes, because in the Poetics, we get really some of the earliest and best definitions of, for instance, tragedy. So that's a great place to start.
Aristotle's Poetics?
Yes.
Okay. What does it take then to be a hero in a tragedy? Or maybe put it differently, what is a tragic hero?
It's someone who's not supremely good or supremely bad, right? If he's supremely good, his suffering would be, it would be impossible to watch it, right? You'd just walk out. It would be unjust. If he's someone who's supremely bad, you would also just root for his destruction, right? There'd be no tragic element to that. So it's someone sort of in the middle, not supremely good, not supremely bad. And he has a certain depth of soul, right? He can suffer. He has a nobility of soul. And he's able to suffer in an extraordinary way.
That makes you sort of wonder what you mean by hero then, because, I mean, we tended to have a superhero sort of image that's conjured up by that name. But it's clear that the word hero there is meaning something completely different. What is it meant by hero itself?
Yeah, I don't think it's completely different. It's just within the context of tragedy, the heroism is a depth of soul that can suffer greatly. So he's the protagonist. He's also heroic in his nobility of soul.
I see. So talk a little bit then about Macbeth as a tragic hero. How is he? How does he fit the definition that you're giving him there?
There's a way to look at kind of a pattern that takes place in tragedy, where there's the tragic hero is confronted with a tragic dilemma, a choice he has to make. We see that in Macbeth. Let me just go through those. So there's a tragic choice. There's a climactic moment where there's sort of no going back. And then there's a period of great suffering and even madness. And then there's often a recognition by the hero that he recognizes he's destroyed himself. And then there's death. Okay, so those are kind of the essential things that you'll see in a tragedy. With Macbeth, it's interesting, when his tragic dilemma is when the weird sisters appear to him and offer him, what they say to him, I'll read from the play here, they say, "All hail Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Glamis, all hail Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Cawdor, all hail Macbeth, thou shalt be king hereafter." And he has to interpret those words. When they say king hereafter, or even Thane of Cawdor, he's not Thane of Cawdor yet, he's definitely not the king at this point. So he's presented with these witches telling him this, and he has to interpret this. This is sort of the dilemma that he faces. What does he do in this case? Does he just wait, or does he somehow take action, given what they tell him here?
The fact that you have, it's the weird sisters, mm-hmm. You know, the weird is this ancient notion of a impersonal fate that,
right,
when weird has decreed it, you're just you're along for the ride. How do you is Macbeth just along for the ride? Is he freely involved in his own decision making? How does that play out? And how can he be a hero if he's not actively doing something?
Right. In ancient tragedies, say a Greek tragedy like Oedipus, he tries to run away from his fate and he can't escape it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Shakespeare's context is different in that he gives his characters a tremendous amount of free will. And so Macbeth can take it as a fate and even calls it a fate at one point. But I think the play is pretty clear that it's actually his own choice. So he can take this as some sort of temptation, or he can take it as a prophecy. And Banquo, you know, the guy right beside him, doesn't act on it because the witches also tell him that his sons will be kings, and he sort of just waits it out. And even Macbeth early on says, "If chance will have me king, why then chance will crown me without my stir." And he knows if he waits there, at least he seems to be saying there, if I wait on this, if chance will have me king, chance will crown me. And then his wife, of course, Lady Macbeth, is maybe the most wicked character in literature. And she comes along and pushes him to take action and actually seize the crown by killing Duncan.
So how long have you been teaching Macbeth for?
I think it's been about 6 years.
Okay, about six times. Yeah. So over the time, are there favorite lines that you go back to, or favorite moments from the play that resonate deeply for you now?
Yes. When I think about that question of the nobility of Macbeth, a lot of students will say, I can't see him as anything but just a villain, right? He's just too wicked to actually feel any pity or fear regarding him. But there's some very poignant moments where, for instance, I read you that passage where he seems to know, I need to wait on this. And even the good King Duncan says, "I will plant you, Macbeth." And in other words, you're going to flourish under me. And Macbeth knows the king's treating me very well here. I will just wait and see what happens with this prophecy. And his wife pushes him, you know, to basically says, "You're not a man if you don't work with me to kill the king. You're not a man if you don't do that." And she has a famous line where she says, "Spirits unsex me here, like make me a man." And then she pushes her husband around, Macbeth around, And he stands up to her for a time, and then he gives in and he goes along with it. And maybe deep down he wanted this too, and he wanted her to push him. But he there's one of my favorite parts of the play is when he's he realizes the dilemma he's in, and he goes ahead and murders the king as the king's staying at his house. It's a huge breach, obviously, of hospitality. It's a huge, a treacherous act to kill your king, especially a good king. And Macbeth, right after it's done, he comes out, and if you ever see a performance of it, one performance I saw where he has the daggers and they're bloody and they're kind of tinkling against each other as he's shaking in horror at what he's done. And his wife says, "Go put those daggers back in there. You know, what are you doing? They have to stay in there. You don't bring them out here." And he says, "I can never look on what I did." So he's like, immediately he regrets it. And then you hear a knocking at the door, and he says, "I wish that were Duncan alive again." So he knew what he was doing. He went right into it and immediately regrets it. And you feel a great deal of pity for him. So there is a certain nobility to Macbeth. In the very beginning of the play, he's the one who wins the battle. You know, he's a hero in that regard. And then you see him giving in and declining by giving in to something he knows is wicked. But you also see him just torn inside because he's not standing up to what he knows is right. But he knows what's right. Mm-hmm. And so you do see that kind of terror in his soul and that excruciating decision that he's made, and he stays with it to the point where I think the climactic moment is when he agrees to have his friend Banquo killed because he's afraid Banquo's going to take the throne after him and all his sons will be kings, and Macbeth doesn't have a son, so he'll have lost the throne he'll lose the throne to Banquo. And then there's just more and more blood. Mm. So some really excellent passages have to do with blood. There's a point where there's the banquet scene where Lady Macbeth is interesting in that she's sort of naive about evil, where she thinks we can do this thing, we can kill the king, and then we can sort of contain the consequences.
And just have it all stop right there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And
how every sin lies to you. Yes.
Right. So she puts on this banquet and says, "Now, honey, just be normal. Let's have a good time, and we're just going to enjoy this evening." And Macbeth just completely losing his mind at this point. And he sent the guys, he sent out these men to go out and kill Banquo and his son. And they come back in and they didn't get the son. They only got Banquo. So it doesn't help really. And he comes in and Macbeth just casually says, "There's blood on your face," to the guy that came into the banquet. He comes into the banquet with blood on his face. "There's blood on your face." And then he talks about, Macbeth says, I'm so steeped in blood a little bit later. So I'm so steeped in blood. It's like I've walked into a river of blood, and it's as tedious to go back as it is to go forward. It doesn't make any difference anymore. Mm-hmm. And so you see Macbeth sort of losing grip on reality, and everything's becoming empty and meaningless.
Wow. So what would you say readers ought to be taking away from Macbeth, aside from, I'm trying to remember how you put it, you know, not falling to the breach of etiquette in hospitality, murdering your house guests, important
yeah,
lesson. But what else would you hope that sticks with your students, or if somebody is wanting to dive into Hamlet, or excuse me, Macbeth now, what would you recommend to them?
Let me just real quick read one other passage that I wanted to get to. This is really famous. You probably heard this, but it's such a great passage. So at the very end, I talked about tragic recognition. Whether or not he understands the consequences of what he's done, or you know, he recognizes it or repents of it, is he doesn't seem to. But he does say this. He realizes how empty he's become. He says, "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." All right, so those are some of the most famous lines in the play.
Yeah.
We can see how at the end he's hollowed out. And so what you get is the play is something of a parable of a man who tries to invert the natural order of things and just, you know, runs face to face with there's certain laws of the world, like,
yeah,
evil, good and evil. The one thing about tragedy is that there's absolutes. So good and evil, time, death, mm-hmm. You just can't, you can't escape certain laws of the universe. And he tries to invert things, like killing your king and taking his place, and instead he destroys himself.
It's just interesting as you read that quote, how many other later works of literature have all, you know, sprung out of the fertile soil of just those few lines of Macbeth. It's inspired quite a lot.
Right, and the other one is Lady Macbeth trying to wash her hands, get the blood off her hands, and she says, out, out, damned spot, out, yes. out, can't get the blood off.
Yeah. Wow. So pushing that out a little bit further then, what other sort of larger lessons ought readers to be walking away from Macbeth with?
Yeah, I think that concept of, I think there's a moral element in that he's like an Adam figure who knows what he's doing and he seizes the fruit prematurely. He should have, Duncan said, I plant you. He should have been patient and waited for that to see what his destiny was. Instead, he takes matters into his own hands and grasps after the crown. But it's also important play in that it's, you might not realize this right up front, but it's actually the last of the great tragedies of Shakespeare. So you have Hamlet first, and then Othello, and then King Lear, and then Macbeth. So it's actually the fourth of his great tragedies. So it's his maturest tragedy, and it's some of his very finest language. So if you love poetry, it's a play that you want to study. It's, the imagery in it is as good as anything Shakespeare ever did. So it's one of his very best.
Well, thanks very much. I think we're going to go ahead and break there, but we'll return next week, continuing on looking at Shakespeare's tragedies with Dr. Greaser. Thank you.